it's exactly what kind of motivates me to continue this work. I think it would be challenging for me to just end the story, or for us to just end the story, saying Black patients with AFib are less likely to get new blood thinners. Right. Of course, that will be important for those with AFib, for those who in cardiology, for those who treat these conditions. But how do we actually apply these findings to the broader healthcare system, to disease management overall?
That was Utibe Essien, our guest this week. Utibe is a health equity researcher and clinician in the VA Pittsburgh Health System and is an assistant professor of medicine at University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine. He joins us today to talk about his work. I'm Audrey Provenzano, and this is Review of Systems from the Harvard Center for Primary Care. Check our website, primarycare.hms.harvard.edu, and click on ROS Podcast along the top to subscribe or find more information about our show, our guest, Dr. Essien, or a link to his work we discussed today, and an archive of our previous podcasts. Thanks for listening. Utibe, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me, Audrey. This is really great to speak with you.
You're a health disparities researcher focusing particularly on racial disparities in cardiovascular outcomes, and you had a very important recent publication in JAMA Cardiology, which we'll talk about in a moment. But I wanted to start with a slightly bigger lens. In your writing and in podcasts that I previously heard you on, you have referenced drivers of racial disparities on different levels, the patient level, the provider level, and the system level. Can you talk a little bit more about this taxonomy and why you think it's a helpful way of thinking about it?
Definitely. So I think since the paper came out and a number of times I get to have the opportunity to speak about disparities, one of the questions that come up is, okay, so what is the one thing that caused those differences, or the one thing that we can do to change? And I do feel like that is a bit narrow of a question. I always kind of tend to think that the issue of disparities is quite multifactorial, and those three buckets that you mentioned, the patient, the provider, and the health system, or even the system outside of healthcare, are really such large pieces of what causes disparities in cardiovascular disease, and general medicine, surgery, et cetera. And I think really being able to think about those factors individually and how they interact together is very important. And I can kind of share some of the factors that I thought apply to our findings, or just I like to think about in generally at each of those levels. But that's really how I am trying to think about health disparities broadly, and trying to play my part at least addressing one of those, or if not a group of those various factors.
So maybe why don't you tell us about your findings in your JAMA Cardiology paper and take us through some of what you think the study reflects on those three levels?
Yeah, definitely. So in our study, we wanted to look at the continuum of management of atrial fibrillation. So atrial fibrillation is a increasingly common heart rhythm disorder in the United States, and especially common as our population starts to age. So we're seeing it a bit more, particularly in primary care, where it typically gets diagnosed and managed. And so based on my clinical experience, I was really interested in that continuum of care, from when a patient first gets diagnosed to whether or not they actually receive anticoagulation or blood thinning for stroke prevention. When they do receive anticoagulation, what agent they're receiving. So are they getting the traditional based warfarin, or are they being started on these novel direct oral anticoagulants, or DOACs, as we call them in our paper. And when they are on anticoagulation, what is the quality of that therapy? Is their INR for patients on warfarin appropriate, or were they receiving the right dosage of the DOAC, the newer medication? And so as we looked across that continuum, I was particularly interested in racial different and ethnic differences in the management of atrial fibrillation. And we found pretty significant marked findings. We found, first of all, that there using a registry of patients with atrial fibrillation, which is where the data came from, patients were pretty well anticoagulated in general. It was about 88% or so of patients overall received some sort of anticoagulation. when we started to really drill down, we saw that after adjusting for some clinical factors, Black patients had about 25% lower odds of receiving any anticoagulation. Mm-hmm. And when we then looked at the novel, newer, direct oral anticoagulants, we saw that Black patients had a 37% lower odds of receiving these newer DOACs. And that those differences persisted even after we controlled for some of the typical measures for socioeconomic status, which in our study included education level, insurance type, and median household income. I think those are really the striking findings of our study, and we can start to think through what were some of the factors that led to those findings as well.
So going back to your taxonomy, you know, what did you identify or what do you think are, you know, patient, provider, and system level aspects that allowed this racism to adversely impact these patients' care?
Yeah, so I think there are various factors, as we mentioned. I think at the patient level, it's really important to think about what do patients think when they're in our office. We tell them they have a new diagnosis or new condition and they need to be on this. How much do they know about what their risk of developing the outcome that we say this medication is going to treat or prevent? How much does that knowledge impact whether or not they're going to be on that medication? How much does the cost of that medication play a role? With studying anticoagulation, warfarin can be as low as $4 to $5 for some patients a month, compared to these newer DOACs, which can range from $400 to $500 a month, and that's out of pocket. Mm. And that's quite a calculus for patients to make once they start thinking about managing and preventing adverse effects from a chronic condition. So I think those factors, how much does trust play in the healthcare system, mm-hmm. at the patient level? You know, there's a new medication. What does that mean to certain patients? Mm-hmm. Is my doctor experimenting on me? Have they used this on other people? And not even knowing others with the medication. I've spoken to a few colleagues who anecdotally have mentioned, well, my patient doesn't know that, hasn't ever seen anyone on this blood thinner, so why would they try it? They'd want to stick with what this tried and true.
Right.
I think those are some patient level. At the provider level, a big piece that we were interested in, as a primary care doc, I was really interested in knowing whether specialty affected use of these newer medications. So cardiologists that I've had a chance to interact with around the country really think that the DOACs are the new game in town, and that's just what everyone should be on. There isn't even a question of any more often of starting someone on warfarin unless there is some kind of contraindication. But at the primary care level, there still is some hesitancy in terms of using these newer medications and comfort with them, and understanding that there is a racial gap in access to specialty care and how that may ultimately have led to some of the outcomes that we found. I mean, understandably, we controlled for specialty in our study and didn't see that really changed the outcomes, but it would be interesting to dive a little bit deeper into that. And I think ultimately thinking about how to answer the question about bias on the provider, on the health system side, and maybe even on the patient side, is something that needs to be addressed, not just for anticoagulation and AFib like we studied, but for a number of various conditions that I'm sure folks could have written a similar research study based on.
Yeah. One other thing about the registry, it's called the Orbit Registry. I noticed that it said it was only about 5% Black patients. The overall population is about 12% in the United States, so it's really not representative. Why do you think that is? And do you think that relates to the outcomes of the study at all?
Yeah, so that's a very important point, and one that we, I believe, briefly mentioned in our discussion is that with clinical trials, with clinical registries, there just remains to be lower rates of minority patients. And one of my co-authors on this study has written a paper looking at the rate of enrollment of minorities in studies looking at and studying anticoagulation, and have kind of reported that the lead lower rates of Black and Hispanic patients in clinical registries, both looking at anticoagulation. There's a recent study looking at gender, race differences in congestive heart failure trials. So this is well has been well shown in a number of cardiovascular spaces. I think the challenge really is a recruiting of minority patients into clinical trials and ultimately studying those populations when we're coming up with clinical guidelines. The extra challenge that we have with thinking about atrial fibrillation disparities is this idea of an atrial fibrillation paradox, where although Black patients have a greater number or tend to have a greater number of risk factors for atrial fibrillation, including hypertension, diabetes, and congestive heart failure, they actually have been shown to have lower rates of AFib, even when controlling for some of these traditional risk factors. And some of that has been thought to be due to genetic factors, and patients of European ancestry actually are more likely to have atrial fibrillation. But the reason we thought that this study was so important is because once you look at a Black patient with atrial fibrillation versus a, comparing to a white patient with atrial fibrillation, Black patients tend to have more of the adverse outcomes, including stroke and death, when we look at those with the condition. So I think, like you mentioned, the challenge of clinical and trials and registries of recruiting minority patients, and how do we ensure that the data that we find from these studies really does apply, like you mentioned, to the overall population.
So what do findings like these, which are, of course, really important, but they are pretty granular and specific, and some of the other studies that you mentioned about congestive heart failure and so on. So these really granular and specific findings, although they're important, how do we use them to fight the broader forces of racism in healthcare?
Yeah, I think that's really an important question, Audrey, and it's exactly what kind of motivates me to continue this work. I think it's would be challenging for me to just end the story, or for us to just end the story, saying Black patients with AFib are less likely to get new blood thinners. Right. Of course, that will be important for those with AFib, for those who in cardiology, for those who treat these conditions. But how do we actually apply those and these findings to the broader healthcare system, to disease management overall? And I think the reality is that whether we're looking at a specific condition like atrial fibrillation, or we expand it out to whether a patient comes into the ED with chest pain, how they're getting treated for their pain, or whether or not they are more likely to go to cardiac catheterization to see if there's some kind of blockage in their heart, how does that vary by a patient's the color of a patient's skin? And in particular, how do we go beyond saying, well, it's probably just their socioeconomic status, or their education level, their literacy level, their income, et cetera. We, in some way, were really able to control for a number of those factors in this study and found that, well, the difference was still significant even when we controlled for that. So what else is out there that we're missing and that we're having a difficult time capturing to really get at the cause of some of these racial differences?
So I want to take a little departure here and talk explicitly about this kind of line connecting examples of racism that I see between, you know, your very important but specific research and some of the broader discussion we're having about racism as a nation right now. You know, I feel like every couple of weeks there's a new horrific video that comes out showing unjust violence or even death to predominantly Black men, you know, Tamir Rice, Trayvon Martin, Philando Castile, just to name a few. And then these really horrible and repeated instances of white people calling the police on Black individuals who are just, you know, kind of living their normal daily lives. You know, there's an example of a guy calling his mom in the lobby of his hotel recently, family having a cookout in a park. You know, just kind of these examples of systemic racism that I see a connection between, you know, your findings and these other examples of systemic racism that continue to plague our society. I don't know if you see that. I wonder if you could talk about that a little bit, if you see those connections?
Yeah, definitely. I think those stories that you share are very difficult and challenging. As an African-American man, that's a life that try to separate sometimes, try to say, well, that's what I listen to on the news, what I talk about with my three siblings, you know, is separate from what I'm doing at the workplace when I'm caring for patients, what I'm doing in front of the computer when I'm doing my research. But I think the area that I have the opportunity to study really does blend these challenges together. You know, I was at the school of Harvard School of Public Health over the last 2 years. I'm doing my research training and had the opportunity to study under or with great people like David Williams, who does a lot of work around racism and discrimination, really has put numbers to the idea that discrimination impacts health outcomes. And increasingly, I think that work is being done right now. That obviously was not a question that we were specifically able to answer with our study, but I do think that that's an area that we continue to need to address, and not just, again, describing and showing that if you feel discriminated, you might be sicker, you might be unhealthier. But what can we do? Like, what are the interventions that can be done to make a difference to clinicians who may have implicit biases that we don't know about, to make sure that when a patient comes into the healthcare setting, they feel comfortable, they feel trusted, they feel supported, they feel cared for, and what happens outside of the hospital too. Obviously, a lot of the conditions that we have the opportunity to care for are not ones that are just hospital or clinic based. They're the ones that are being affected by our patients' social situations and circumstances, and how can we address those, including an issue like systemic racism, to make sure that our society is healthier. I really do feel like that's an area that research and the health community needs to continue to push towards to really start to address health disparities as a whole.
Yeah. So I wanted to stop here and introduce a poem. We really tried to bring a lot of narrative in to the podcast because I think it can really more completely capture and transmit fully and truthfully important issues in a different way than we talk about in research. So this poem is by Lauren Alleyne, and it was published in the Atlantic Magazine last year. It's called Martin Luther King Jr. Mourns Trayvon Martin. And it imagines what Martin Luther King might say in response to the murder of Trayvon Martin. So I'll read it, and then I would love to hear what line you might draw between this poem and your research, because again, I see a connection, and I want to explore that. So this is by Lauren Alleyne, Martin Luther King Jr. Mourns Trayvon Martin. For you, son, I dreamed a childhood unburdened by hate, a boyhood of adventure, skinned knees and hoops, first loves and small rebellions. I dreamed you whole and growing into your own manhood, writing its definitions with your daily being. I dreamed you alive, being. I dreamed you alive, living. For you, America's African heir, I dreamed a future of open doors, of opportunity, without oppression, of affirmation and action. I dreamed Oprah and Obama. I dreamed Colin and Condoleezza. I dreamed doctors and dancers, lawyers and linebackers, models, musicians, mechanics, preachers, and professors, and police, authors, activists, astronauts even, all black as Jesus is. I dreamed you dapper, the black skin of you polished to glow, your curls, your kinks, your locks, your bald, your wild, your freshly barbered, all beautiful. I dreamed you wearing whatever the hell you want and not dying for it. For you, brother, I dreamed a world softened by love, free from the fear that makes too early ancestors of our men, turns our boys into targets, headlines and ghosts. I had a dream that my children will one day live in a nation where they are not judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. Sweet song of my sorrow, sweet dream deferred. For you, gone one, I dream justice, her scales tipped away from your extinction, her eyes and arms unbound, and open to you at last. What are your thoughts or reactions to that?
Yeah, that's such a powerful poem and narrative, and really appreciate you bringing that to the conversation. Again, it's hard to separate sometimes the stories, the headlines, the realities from the work that we do, and I think I will continue to use the narratives and the stories outside of the everyday clinical and research spaces to really inform and drive and motivate my questions. The piece and the part of the poem that really stuck out to me was Sweet Dream Deferred. Mm. And just thinking about the loss and what has been deferred, what people are losing when they lose their lives much earlier than expected, mm-hmm. as much as we can expect, obviously. One of the most memorable moments in class during my public health degree was the moment where Ichiro Kawachi was one of our professors, and he brought up a slide where he showed a number of obituaries, and this was led to one of his questions around mortality and racial differences, and showed that, you know, time after time, the African Americans who are written in obituaries are dying young. There's the 44-year-old African American man, the 50-something-year-old woman, the 20-something-year-old, and the age just continues to feel like it's dropping and dropping. Whereas when we think about other races, it's the 90-year-old businessman, it's the 97-year-old woman, and for some reason, white people seem to have much higher death rates in obituaries than their African-American counterparts, and that's something that obviously plays out in the data when we look at the mortality data and how it's just younger, lower rate for black men in particular than for the other demographics. And I just think that's such a driver, again, for this work. It's whether it's related to violence and out in the world, or whether it's related to the care that people of color receive. How can we, as providers, as researchers, as a health system, continue to make inroads to make sure that dreams aren't deferred on our watch as much as we can, is really what stood out to me in that poem.
Yeah. So I want to close by asking you about another publication you recently had. It was a really wonderful commentary calling on those of us in primary care to collaborate more closely with obstetrics. I think in response to the growing awareness in the United States about increasing rates of maternal mortality, particularly among black women. And so you wrote on Twitter when you posted the article, which is really wonderful and everyone should go and read, and we'll link along with your JAMA paper on our website. You wrote that part of what you inspired to do this work was your mom's experience when she was pregnant. And also you talk about a particular woman, Dr. Shalon Irving. I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about the paper and your family's experiences.
Yeah, definitely. So over the last year or so, I think, as you mentioned, there's been such a increase in awareness and discussion about maternal mortality and morbidity and disparities in that line. And that was just such a striking an area for me. And I think back in, I guess, December or so of last year, I just wrote a quick little piece and sent to my colleagues who we finally were able to publish this piece with, and said, well, what do you think? This is December of 17. What do you guys think? I kind of want to share a story about my family and about this Dr. Shalon Irving, who was a public health researcher with the CDC, who unfortunately had experienced loss of life during shortly after her pregnancy. And wanted to kind of relate that all together to what role that we can play in primary care. Because I think, again, not wanting to do more than just describing and saying, yes, we've seen that black women unfortunately have higher morbidity and mortality rates after pregnancy than other races, but what can we do practically to address this issue? And what can I do as a PCP who is caring for women who have hypertension, who have diabetes, who may have obesity, who are going into pregnancy and potentially at risk? And what can I do on the other side of their mm-hmm. pregnancy as well? And what can we do as in primary care? So that's what really drove that piece and drove these questions. You know, my mom, there's four of us as kiddos that she had, all via C-section, and she, starting with me, had preeclampsia, had to deliver early, mm-hmm. All the way to my youngest brother, where she ended up requiring an emergency hysterectomy after mm-hmm. her surgery, after her delivery, rather. And, of course, none of us were there in the OR or with the docs and team thinking about what were going on or how we could have prevented that dire circumstance, which fortunately she is healthy, alive, well, and has raised us all to be at least my siblings are, the special human beings that they are. But that could have gone very, very poorly, and I just have been really struck by the stories that we hear and continue to hear, unfortunately, and every time it just brings me back to, you know, July 12, 85, and August 24th, 1990, where we just, who knows what could have happened mm-hmm. With my mom and how different our lives could have been. And again, drawing on the stories that our patients, everyday people, are before they become patients, they're just everyday people are experiencing that are transforming their lives forever, and we have the opportunity and the privilege to care for them, to teach them, to educate them, and to treat them, and again, to do our part to help reduce, eliminate, stop any of these negative outcomes, whether it's during pregnancy or during the treatment of a chronic condition when you're in your 70s or 80s. Mm. And I think that's really, again, what motivated our work.
Well, Bativa, thank you so much for your time and for your really important work.
Thanks so much, Audrey. I really appreciate you addressing this issue on your podcast. I know there's so many things that we can talk about in healthcare, and I really appreciate that you're considering this as one of those issues, and thank you for everything that you do here.
You've been listening to Review of Systems, a podcast featuring conversations about the changing healthcare landscape from the Harvard Center for Primary Care. I'm Audrey Provenzano. Check our website, primarycare.hms.harvard.edu, and click on RO's podcast along the top to find more information about the show, links to subscribe, and links to the publications we discussed from our guest, Dr. Essien, and a link to the poem we discussed today. If you enjoy the show, please rate, review, and subscribe wherever you listen. It helps others find the show and share us on social media. You can find our guest, UTV, on Twitter. UTV, what's your handle?
My handle is URSIEN, ESSIEN.
Great. And you can find me at Audrey MDMPH and our show at ROS Podcast. Thanks so much for listening.